If you are someone who's looking to learn more about fertility awareness method for natural birth control or conception, and you're ready to finally get to the root of hormone imbalances for good, this is the podcast for you. The cool thing is, Fertility Awareness Method is here for you in all seasons of your life. When you're looking to prevent pregnancy, when you're ready to conceive, and when you want to use it postpartum. So if you're in the phase of your life where you are looking for a natural form of birth control without all the hormones, head on over to my free training, nourishedwithnina.com/famtraining for all of the information. All right, let's go ahead and hop right into this new episode.
You always have the choice to say no to something or for me to call in somebody else and offer a second opinion. Like, I leave those doors open for patients so that they can make the decision that works for them.
Hey everyone, welcome back to a new episode of the Healing Hormones Podcast. I'm Nina Boyce, your host, certified fertility awareness educator and Reiki practitioner. And today we are talking all about midwifery with certified nurse midwife and women's health nurse practitioner, Ayanna Davison. She currently practices in Southern California and is passionate about shedding light on and aiding to eradicate the inequalities that exist within healthcare, addressing the crisis that Black women face in the U.S., the provision of quality care for all individuals and families, and the preservation of the legacy of Black midwives and birth work. And let me tell you, we go through all of this in the podcast, and I am so, so grateful for her coming on the show and sharing and really educating us on the rich and wonderful history of midwifery and Black midwifery. And I really hope that you guys take the knowledge and information in this podcast episode. And at the end, we are going to link and share resources where you can support and do your part to help to spread this awareness and make some critical changes within our healthcare and conventional medical system. We also touch on what a midwife is, why you might want to work with one, and what you can expect if you're interested in working with this type of practitioner. I personally did through OSU, and I loved my experience, and I'll share a little bit more about that within the episode. Okay, well, without any further hesitation, let's go ahead and hop right into this conversation with Ayanna. Hi, Ayanna. Thanks so much for joining the podcast today. I've been wanting to get a midwife on the podcast since I knew I was pregnant. And so, I mean, now I'm 3 months postpartum, but it's never too late to talk to a midwife. So thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me. So happy to be here.
You're welcome. Now, I'm curious, what led you to midwifery and, like, you know, even the gynecological space? Like, have you always been interested in this work? Was it something that you were, like, led to gradually? Like, how did you end up in this space?
Yeah, so it's always like a little bit of a journey, but I feel definitely called to this profession and to this work. It started with me wanting to go to medical school to be an OBGYN. I saw birth at an early age in school, and like, it's not like any family member or friends. It was like in school. And I was probably one of the few kids who wasn't freaking out at like this human being coming out of vagina.
Wait, how old were you when this happened?
Ooh, elementary, maybe middle school.
And it wasn't family, like, it happened at school. I'm confused. I need the backstory. Yeah, here.
sex ed class, or they may not have been calling it that at the time. As a matter of fact, I remember us going to, I was born and raised in Massachusetts, and we went to the Children's Museum or some type of museum. There was a place where we saw a video of a baby being born.
Oh my gosh.
And so I stayed. Everyone else like left and I stayed, and I was like, this is the coolest thing ever.
I love that.
And not even that. And I can only interpret it now as an adult as what I thought in my head. I was like, oh my gosh, like honoring and respecting what's happening in front of me. Because it was like, I'm not going to run away from this. I didn't force myself to sit through anything I didn't want to see, but I was like, this is interesting.
As a child, you were immediately like intrigued by this, by birth.
Yeah. And in my life and whatever I do, I think I strive to offer service. That's like my personality. Like, how can I help others? And so, you know, I was thinking of what how can I do this? And the only thing I knew of at the time was becoming like an OBGYN. So that was the route that I took. And those doors just it was not my path. It was not my path. And I discovered nursing. And so with nursing school, my eyes were open to midwifery a little bit before that too, you know, got into discussion, had never stepped in a birth center, never been like, you know, at a live birth until my later years. But that was the path I wanted to go. And as soon as like the nursing school kind of hit me, it was like everything was, my steps were the way they were supposed to go. So I took that as like my universal yes or my God yes. And went with it. And then before I started midwifery school, my grandmother passed. And in her passing, I found out that she was a midwife in the island of Antigua. That's where my family hails from. Didn't know this. I knew my grandmother was a nurse, but I never knew her to be a midwife. She wasn't a secretive person, but she had to do some digging. And so she's my earliest pen pal. We talked all the time, but that side, I didn't know about her.
Wow.
And she was a certified nurse midwife.
Surprised. She never
talked about like her as a registered nurse in the States, and all of that led her up, you know, pretty much immigrated here with her family and her five children at the time. My last aunt was born in the States, but everybody else was born at home, in the island of Antigua, and, brought her family, her husband and kids on the nursing license. And so I have a few of her things, and it's just, you know, it's nice to see them. I wish I had the conversation, you know, I do wish I had the stories and her accounts. But I'm going to do a little bit more digging and find out more. So
I've heard that like healers or midwives or, you know, teachers or caregivers, like it really is like a something that travels through the lineage. And so it doesn't surprise me that you found it out later. Like it was seriously something that just gets passed down, and it must have got passed down right to you.
I truly believe it's in the bloodlines. You know, midwifery really is a calling. And I mean, whether or not you take up the job, because we can work anywhere, right? Anyone could do pretty much anything. Like if you put your mind to it, I feel like you can get through it. But there's really something innate that walks you through. And people who I feel are called, or you can recognize a calling in them, there's certain things that happen along the way that you're just like, oh, wow. Like, you know, it's just like, this is truly meant for you. And I definitely feel that in my steps in midwifery. And I'm so excited to see what else is coming, because I know there's so much more. But for sure in the bloodlines, I also had another cousin, more of my grandmother's cousin, who was also a midwife. She passed away as well. And so it's in there, it's in us.
Yeah. Oh, that makes total sense to me. So I find, even, you know, it's 2021, I still feel like people really don't know what a midwife is. And I remember when I told my mom and my mother-in-law that I was using the midwives, they were like, what's that mean? Like, are you sure that's okay? Like, and I do things a little bit unconventionally sometimes. So they're like, what are you doing? And, you know, there's two sides to it. Like I could have chosen to have, a home birth and have a midwife come to my place, but I'm in an apartment, and that just didn't seem like a, you know, something that fit for this first birth. And then I also had the option to do the midwives at OSU and deliver in a hospital. And that's the route that I went. And I just feel like there's a lot of confusion. Like people don't know the options with midwifery. They think that you are just doing things like in the woods and delivering a baby. Like they just have no idea. So can you share a little bit about like what this practice is and what it isn't? And then I would love to dive into the history too.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a long-standing history. We are maybe one of the earliest professions, because as babies came into the world, there were people that needed to be there to help guide them in. And so so we're definitely, you know, we're definitely doing that. But midwifery, and yes, we will find you in the woods and the forest, like you said, if you want to deliver there or have your baby there, that's where we'll be. You know, in school, they prepped us like, have your elevator speech ready, because, and it's true. I'm so glad they told us this, because it's like, people don't know, and you need to be ready on a whim to tell them what it is that you do. But basically, we are healthcare providers. And I want to start with that because we do have the background and training, whether we're practicing in the hospital or at home or in a birth center or by the water, or traditionally midwives have training and they are providers, they're healers. They are people who are providing care to a low risk person. So meaning they're not having major complications during their care. And we help people along their life journey. So it's from, I always say, from like menarche to menopause, and menarche is like the beginning of your periods, to menopause and beyond all that and in between. So we help you along the way, whether it be contraception, birth control counseling, abortion care, pregnancy care, fertility care, your pap smear, your annual screening, breast exams. We do it all, birth and postpartum. And then we also care for the newborn up to 21 days after they're born. So it really is comprehensive, and that scope, you know, spans not just like the one person, but it's family centered, you know? So whatever that looks like for you, family can be two people, it could be one person, you know, and their child or what have you, but we're there to help people along their journey with their health. And sometimes, you know, folks, they don't see a care provider until they get pregnant. And so we sometimes are doing a little bit of like the general practitioner type thing when we see them. And so to have a knowledge of that and understanding and able to offer care for folks is really, you know, that central basis for midwifery. Yeah.
I like that you started like you're a healthcare professional. Like, I think a lot of times people don't understand that. They think, oh, it's either you're using a doctor or midwife, are they actually trained? It's like, oh my gosh, they go through so much schooling. Like, and that's something that is just not known. Is it like, and that's something I always was curious with, like, is that a master's program that you have to go through for midwifery and you have to do like a nursing bachelor's first? Or can you kind of do, can you kind of pick and choose what you want?
So there are several different, midwifery is an umbrella term. There are several different types of midwives. And that's where it kind of gets a little dicey, because I think people think, oh, you're at home, so then you don't really know like what you're doing, but you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you're having a baby at home, you know?
Yeah.
It's an umbrella term. There are several different types of midwives. You have certified nurse midwife, that's myself. And I'll explain that in a second. You'll have licensed midwives or certified professional midwives, certified midwives, and then you have your traditional midwives as well. I don't think I've missed anybody. I think I've covered everyone. So a certified nurse midwife has nurse in the name. So we actually do have a nursing background. So usually registered nurse, and then yes, a master's level program. And that includes like a preceptorship, meaning time spent like in depth with, you know, one-on-one, someone training you to get through this program and to really immerse you. Traditionally, going back to like, and that's one of the earliest types of midwives, these are people who, it's like an innate type of thing. So they go through their own training and learning. It may not be accredited, but it is, you're following someone. It's like kind of like an apprenticeship. Or
I was just going to say, yeah,
you're doing that. And that is really more of a holistic, I mean, midwifery on a whole is, I feel like, a more holistic approach to healthcare, but they really do get down to, you know, the core of who we are as humans. And that's what I appreciate. And not that other types of midwives don't, but like, this is like kind of their focus. And then you'll have licensed midwives, and they also do have to go through training. They do not have to have a nursing background or a science background, but they do go through school and accreditation, and they sit for boards just like we sit for our national certifying exam. And then the only hiccup there or difference there is they do not practice in the hospital. So no, I don't believe any of the 50 states that we have allow for licensed midwives to practice in the hospital. There is another type of midwife who can practice in the hospital, and that's a certified midwife. They do have a science background. They're not nurses, but they have a science background, have to do training similar to what certified nurse midwives do. And then they can, in certain states, they can practice in the hospital. And what's really important too is like, depending on the state that you're in determines what type of midwife can practice outside of the hospital independently, or can practice, you know, and needs a physician as a supervisor. And that's the language that we use. So if you're looking for midwifery care for your pregnancy and birth, it's really important to determine what state you're in and what the regulations are. And then your midwife should be going over that with you if you choose to go through care with them, especially if it's outside of the hospital. And I like to point out too, because like people often get midwife and doula confused,
right?
And they're two totally different things. So while we walk in alignment with each other, many times we're doing different things for the same goal. So again, midwives are healthcare providers. We're offering this care to people, medical care, diagnosis, treatment, assessment. Doulas are supportive personnel for your pregnancy journey, postpartum. There's all types of doulas, like there's sex doulas, there's end of life doulas. But when we're talking about birth and postpartum and pregnancy, doulas are like a support person. They're there to provide resources, help you with your pregnancy, you know, journey, but are not to offer medical like advice. And then also they're not supposed to deliver a baby. Like that's, you know, that's not part of their scope. You can be at 1,000 births, but that's still not part of the scope unless you have the training. So it's very a thin line. And I do believe in the work of doulas because they really do guide people, especially in the early labor stages, but postpartum, like so many different aspects. And it's just the two, because we walk so closely together many times, sometimes confused.
I had both because I use, you know, the midwives for my delivery and through all of my appointments and care. And then I had a doula, Simi, for those that were listening. I recorded an episode with her and it was great. Like during my birth, she was there like rubbing my back and my feet and asking if I needed a popsicle. And my husband was, you know, doing the same thing, but it's different because she knows like the certain things to say or can coach my husband with something to do. So it's like a completely different support than also what my midwife was giving me. Right. So yeah, totally know that. My mother and mother-in-law were also confused about that. They're like, wait, you have a doula, like, you're using a midwife. What's going on here? But I highly recommend, like, if you do have the means to do it, it's a great thing to look into with getting a doula. And I obviously loved using the midwives for my delivery. But I want to talk too about the history, because I know that there's like a rich Black history that goes along with midwives and where everything started. And I would love for you to touch on that too.
Yeah. When we think about midwifery here in the United States, we're talking about something that, again, passed on legacy. And it's important for folks to know that this is not like a trend or something new. This is not, I recently saw someone I followed like posted like in the 60s and 70s, midwifery was revitalized, but I really like think it was just recolonized because it was something that was in practice for a long period of time. And enslaved people who were brought to this country had to bring along the resources that they used for birth and for their care. And so, you know, many times as an enslaved person, you didn't have access to a doctor. You had who was in your group, whoever was in there to provide you care, or if there was a doctor, they weren't going to treat you well, you know? So midwives were, this is a legacy that's continued and come across. And I also want to honor and acknowledge Indigenous midwives, because before anyone else got here, there were midwives here who were attending births for the people of this land before anyone else was here. So, you know, there's that rich history as well, but in terms of Black midwifery, we're talking about people who, again, these are healers for the community. So, you know, you stubbed your toe, your toe's broken, they're going to come see you. You know, they're offering a wide variety of things. You might be experiencing loss. They had the herbs, the hands, the gut, the heart to help heal or, you know, walk you through that journey. So there's a lot of rich history there. And, you know, Black women on the whole, for obstetrics and gynecology were like the foundation for how we get our practices in anesthesia now. And the repairs and the things that we do to make sure your vagina stays okay after you have a baby. So, you know, you've heard of like J. Marion Sims and how he practiced on many enslaved women Black women without the use of anesthetic because we were deemed to not have, like, we didn't feel pain.
I've heard that. And yeah, it blew my mind. I had no idea.
Literally, I mean, like, I like to think of it as this, is that Black women have essentially carried us into the modernization of obstetrics and gynecology and many aspects of healthcare. And so without anesthesia, without, with repetitive surgeries and trying in the experimentation without permission. So, you know, we're in a time where we're talking about consent and informed consent and shared decision-making. They had none of this as, available to them. It was taken from them. And so, so that in combination with, the legacy of Black midwives, these are, you know, there are people who didn't want to be midwives, but again, that calling and that because of where you are and where you stand, you have to go and serve your community. And there's, you know, several, midwives from history who, you know, attended many, 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 many births. Like we're talking thousands of babies and we're doing an amazing job. And then with the modernization of medicine comes hospital systems.
Right.
And then kind of this white dictatorship saying like, what you're doing is not going to benefit us. So we're going to come in and modify or shut it all down, which is essentially kind of along the lines of what happened. So I always say like black midwifery is not dead. People think that like, you know, we're few and far between. We're, you know, if we're talking about this certified nurse midwife or CNM rates, we're less than 6 to 8% nationally. Mm-hmm. And then out of like about 360 birth centers in America, I would say 13 are black owned. So, you know, there really is this need for more black and brown people to be the creators, the disruptors, as I say, and the owners of these facilities, because we need to serve our people. So basically, as these hospital systems are developing, white doctors who are, again, we're always practicing medicine. This is not a complete art and science. You know, it's something that's always being developed and turned around and turned over, advanced. But with all of that, you know, it was almost as if they stepped in and saw the good that was happening within the communities of Black midwives and said, well, you're not doing this correctly, or what you're doing is not sanitary. So you need to go to training for this. And then they begin to kind of abolish, you know, the midwifery care. So, you know, if you went and were going to be a healer or be a midwife, that was essentially illegal at some point in time for certain states and cities and counties. So you see the dwindling off, but not the eradication, because we're pretty resilient. So those things live on. And here's where we talk about legacy too. Many of this is much of the knowledge that the midwives had was passed down to, you know, their children if possible, but not always. And there's things that, you know, life factors that come in, stepping in the way, and it's not always possible for it to be continued, but somehow these factors, these little things have continued on. And you really do see the resurgence of midwifery with like Ina Mae Gaskin. But again, that is another interpretation of the healing art of midwifery that Black midwives have. And it really is, it's not the same. It's still important, but it's not the same as, you know, as our history and our legacy has shown. So yeah, it's pretty vast.
What I find to be conflicting is, you know, I really truly believe in like the wisdom of our ancestors and the wisdom of people that have been practicing these things for generations and generations and being passed down. And like when conventional medicine gets in the way, I mean, there's also so many benefits to conventional medicine. Like I appreciate and respect so many things about that. But I find that it does get in the way and sometimes. And there's like, for example, someone stepping in and saying, well, this isn't sanitary or this isn't, you're not doing this correctly. We're going to have to put all of these structures around it. And then so many people get shut out just because we have to follow these arbitrary, I don't know if they're arbitrary, but follow these rules and systems that somebody else has chosen like needs to happen. And I, like, how do we, maybe we're doing a better job now, I don't know, but like, how do we start blending those two worlds? Because they're still so extreme. And I feel like there's this middle ground in there that we need to really work on blending together.
Right. I mean, what you're talking about, what you're describing is to a T what like the systems that are in place that are inherently racist. that is what they're designed to do. They're not designed to come in and be conforming to what is already happening. They're not designed to like uplift the Black community. They're designed to destroy what is there. And, you know, it's seen in how hospital practice goes. I work in the hospital, so I understand this and I see this. And for those who have not lived it, it may be unbelievable, but when you see a patient treated differently because of their skin color, or you hear the things that are said, amidst coworkers or in the hospital setting, it is really cringeworthy. And also the reality that these systems were not designed for Black people in mind. They were designed for, you know, white people. And that's the bottom line. That's the truth. There's no doubt.
And we're not making any adjustments. Like, do you see any adjustments changing in this yet? Or do you really see that it's like just being carried through and you're this observer watching and saying like, hey, this is an issue. And I will say I've heard, you know, recently with everything going on, now this is finally starting to come out. And I have to know, you know, my own ignorance. I didn't know much about that either until people started speaking up. And my mind is like, how is this still happening now?
So the thing is, we have social media now and we have more access at our fingertips to see certain things. And I think that's how we get to visualize these things. But what's been happening is Black people, I'll be specific, Black women have been screaming about their care for a long time. And some have stayed silent because we're complacent, because we're taught that the doctor knows better. And that's, again, part of the structural racism, institutionalized racism that's passed down to us. And then it's heavily ingrained in our spirits and, you know, in how we operate. Going back to what you mentioned before, I do believe there can be a kind of a melding of modern technology as well as holistic practice. But for the structures that are in place now, I'm getting less and less hopeful about it. And so in order for the structure to be different, that foundation has to change. And the foundations, while the new future of midwifery, like the students that are out there, are completely radical and I love it.
Yeah.
Many of them are speaking up. They're active, you know, the activists, they are protesting. They are calling people out, which is so important. There's still this heavily ingrained racism, and it might be ever so subtle, so much to the point that when we point it out, people, it's almost like a gaslighting situation. It's like, oh no, that's not. Right. But, you know, I heard one, what was I listening to the other day or maybe watching? And they were talking about the Black maternal health crisis, which, you know, Black mothers are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth and postpartum than white counterparts. And someone said, oh, well, what Black people are we talking about? But the bottom line is this accounts for all Black people, no matter your demographics, your financial status, your educational background. We have Black doctors who have died, even as recent as last year during the pandemic, because of these, you know, because of systematic racism. Like that's, you know, that is, I'll never shy away from that. Like we can say, oh, postpartum hemorrhage, but how were you treated during the hemorrhage? Right. We can say internal bleeding, you know, after cesarean section. But like, how many times did she have to call and ask for help? I have my own accounts as a postpartum nurse when I was working as a registered nurse, as well as a labor and delivery nurse, of folks who have survived because things have been spoken out for, and then folks who have died because they were not listened to. And that is like the blatant truth and reality. Believe what you want. I see it all the time. And it's time for folks to open up their eyes. So, you know, will this get better? Is there hope? not unless the foundation changes. And that essentially means the eradication or the redevelopment of our systems.
That's what I was exactly going to ask, because what it comes down to is the people that are caring for Black mothers, birthing people, like they're just they're not doing care the same. Like they, and again, do you think that's, I guess I don't even know how to ask the question. Like, why is that? It's just because of systemic racism. They're just not.
How do you teach someone who doesn't care not to be racist?
Right.
How do you teach somebody that the way that they've been treating people for so long is not appropriate? Like, you know, you have to know your value system. You have to know how you feel. And if you have been taught in a way, there have been plenty of examples, like, you know, folks, Black folks going to the ER, urgent care, oh, they're just pain seeking, like, or they're, you know, seeking medication for pain relief. And really and truly, like, they have something else going on, you know, whereas like someone else may come in and it's like they're in pain and they get the medication that they need and the assistance that they need right away. Someone else might be waiting for hours. Yeah. And I get that everything is, you know, situational, it's by circumstance. However, more often than not, even in our school system and midwifery included, like we are not, you know, separate from all of this. It is also very much a problem within our midwifery community where there's like an elite supremacy that I feel many white midwives, not all, but many white midwives have. Like I get to say so, I get to do without that, again, shared decision-making, seeing the person that's in front of you, you know, that we're all humans. This, I mean, color matters, obviously, but like this should not determine how you're going to treat me. Like we shouldn't be having that conversation. Right. We should be saying, this is the issue. I need to address X, Y, and Z. Like even as recent as this week, I had a girlfriend, she's a doula, and had a patient who was in labor and wanting to do a vaginal birth after C-section. And her nurse told her it wasn't going to happen. Labor hadn't even started yet. And the nurse
and just shut it down.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And because of a Black midwife who worked at is the former practice that I was at, she was the one who was there and attended her birth and was like, you know, started saying, why are you treating her like this?
So she called it out and stepped in. Yeah.
Yes. But if we don't, if people don't call it out, if we let it roll off of our shoulders, right. What are we really doing? You know, there's a lot of cultural competency that's going on in hospital systems now because they're recognizing it's an issue, but people still brush that off and ignore it. And they make these comments. I'm around it. I hear it.
Yeah. You know? I was going to say you're in the hospital system. So you are seeing it firsthand.
Yep. Yep. It doesn't sit well. And I think, you know, in my own personal professional journey, I'm making changes because if I stay in this place, well, let me back up. Most of my community, Black people, are going to have insurance that allows them to go to the hospital and have their birth or their well person care. And I understand that. And so with that being said, we need Black people in the hospital system too. And it was a doula who called that out in me. I'll always tell this story. Like I felt ashamed for a while when I first started midwifery because I was like, my people need me in my community and I need to be out there doing things. And she's like, no. Our people are going to the hospital. So you need to be there because they need to meet you there.
Yeah.
And so like, don't discount where you are in your life and in your journey because someone needs to meet you where you are and you need to meet them where they are. And that is like an ordained space. That's a space that's designed for you guys to be there together. However, the toils, the burnout, the, what midwifery encompasses in the hospital system, for some, they can do it for 30 years. For me, what I recognize is I need to define midwifery for myself. And I encourage anyone who's a midwife listening or has aspirations for midwifery, don't rely on what they make it about in school. Rely on what it looks like for you, for your community, for the people you want to serve. So staying in this space, I could see myself becoming more and more complacent if I were to allow myself to stay there. And that's just, it doesn't agree with my spirit.
I feel like when you're continually fighting and seeing so much that needs to be changed, how can it not burn you out after? It's like there's only so much you feel like you can do. And I love that you said, like, it doesn't align with, I think you said your spirit or something, but like keeping the core of what you're doing makes so much sense as to like, why am I doing this? Why am I sharing this? And if your path needs to venture off in another way, like you're still holding on to that core of why you're choosing midwifery.
Right, right. Yep, that's exactly it.
So to me, it seems like, again, like sharing this and education around this is what's going to at least hopefully start to turn the dial. It seems very overwhelming when you think of like uplifting a whole foundation of, what's the word I'm looking for? conventional medicine, like in the way that it's been built. And I hope that, like, again, through education and more people coming in like you and working in the hospitals and getting their certifications and sharing this, that there will be more people in the medical community that are educated on what's going on. It will hopefully start to shift. But it does feel very overwhelming. And I can't even imagine, you know, being in your position and what you're seeing, how it doesn't burn you out.
It is. It is. And that's another issue, too, is we can get all these, you know, a diverse midwife field, but the sustainability is the next issue. And the same thing with Black birth centers. Like, there have been plenty who have started and had to close because where's the money coming from? Like, you know, there may be disadvantaged populations you want to, you know, assist, but how do you assist them if like the funds aren't there for it? So sustainability is a big deal. And then recognizing that, again, midwifery has its hiccups, as much of the medical system does. So once we, you know, once we have more Black professors or more diverse, a more diverse educational experience, or more diversity within midwifery, what are we doing to keep them in there and to prevent them from burning out? Yeah. Because, you know, their journeys, even clinical preceptorship, I talked about, you know, what we have to do to get through our programs, you're paired with somebody. And sometimes that doesn't align. And while certain people may learn best from their own, it's not always the case. I had an amazing white preceptor, and she is an ally. She's somebody who met me at my level. And even now she's like, I can't even imagine what you're going through, but like, I'm here for you. And like, I don't stand for X, Y, and Z, you know? And so that's helpful. But how many people are experiencing that? There are too many stories from our students who are also experiencing, like, again, the lack of sustainability, the lack of meshing well with their preceptors. So this is why I'm talking about the foundations. We really have to, like, you know, who is out there to be in favor for folks going through this journey and being supported in the way that they need, you know? And once you get into that system, how do you stay there without like destroying yourself?
Yeah.
That's a reality, you know?
Is there anything that anyone listening or, you know, people with podcasts, is there anything we can do specifically besides sharing the education to help? I mean, that's kind of a loaded question. So, and I know you're probably, honestly, to be honest, you're probably sick of hearing the question. But if there's anything that comes up off the top of your head.
Like number one, listen to Black people. Like when we speak, we're not just like saying it out the corner of our mouth. Like, this is, you know, when we say something, we mean it. And I'm not just talking about patients. I'm talking about the educators. You know, sometimes we say things and it's like not heard. And then someone else who doesn't look like us says the same thing. And it's like everyone hears it. And I'm like, that's the same thing that I just said. Like, you know, this is, you know, so listening to Black folks and Black and brown people for what they have to say, because we're, you know, again, we're human too. We're not less than, and we're also not fighting to be better than, you know. When we talk about initiatives like Black Lives Matter, like, we're not saying Black lives are better than, we're saying like, we simply matter.
Yep.
Like, you know, the house on fire example is something that was highly impactful for me. It's like, you know, you see this house on fire, people are trying to like, you know, get to the fire, and someone else is over here like, well, what about my house? But your house is not on fire.
Oh, I've not heard that. And that resonates. So that makes so much sense.
Yeah. You're not having the same, you know, poor outcomes. You're not seeing people die at the hands of like racist providers or racism in general. Like, we're trying to, you know, like, dull this fire down, like, get it out. Your house is fine.
Yeah.
Your house is fine. And if there's a problem, like, let's, you know what, to be fair, let me say this, to be fair, we talk a lot about, like, Black healing and this generational trauma from enslavement. And that's true. But there's also healing that has to happen for white people as well, because you come from a lineage of the enslavers. Like, and so what is that left in your cells? What is that left? I truly believe in things that have been passed down. We just talked about that too. There's healing that has to tap, you know, has to take place there too. But you also have to accept that this is what happened, you know? So if we continue to pretend like this was something that never happened, if we eradicate things like, what did they do? I can't remember the name of it. This is terrible. This is my brain. But pretty much, like, oh, it's going to kill me, but it'll come back. But they're banning, like, teaching about, you know, the true history. If we eradicate that and take it out of textbooks or take it out of learning, then how do we even know that there ever was a problem? Things like the Tulsa riots, or you know the destruction of that city in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I didn't learn about that in school. I didn't, and I don't think many of us did. You know, and it's just, these are things that have to be tackled early on and taught early on, so people are aware. And then, you know, you make your own decision. Are people always going to be like, Black Lives Matter? No. But, like, it's time to make a change. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say, like, I was very ignorant to my own healing for a while. And it wasn't until all of these things that have been happening in the past year have brought up, I mean, just what you said, like, I had to reflect on myself. Like, I was one of those people's like, I'm not racist, you know? Mm-hmm. And you have to, and again, like, I was ignorant to that. Like, oh, of course not. But you really do have to sit back and think, like, wow, what are some of these beliefs that I might be harboring, or like subconsciously or consciously, like, doing that I don't realize is making a, not moving the dial in the right direction.
Right, right.
And I'm obviously passionate about birth and hormones and women's health and fertility. And so that's why the conversation that we're having right now, I think, is so important, because that's sort of like my sector. Like, how can we at least broaden the awareness in this small section of the world that I seem to focus on and share? So I, like, so appreciate you diving into all of that with us. It's very important that we keep having these conversations.
Absolutely. The conversations are important. Like I said, listening, if you feel like you have the funds to donate, donating to Black birthing centers, donating to organizations like Sister Song, reproductive rights organizations, Black Mamas Matters Alliance, places that are really trying to not only spread the information, but also make radical change. So not just in the healthcare sector, but also policy, research, all these avenues that have used Black and brown bodies and what we have to offer, but haven't necessarily compensated them. It's time, and this is what they're doing within the organizations. It's time that we are the ones who are, you know, creating these research projects, conducting them, and then returning them back to our communities so that they know. And it's not just like, oh, we're going to do this experiment on you with no anesthesia and this is going to be the way. And when we go to do it on a white person, then we'll do the anesthetics. And then also we'll have the best possible outcome here because we've practiced so much on someone else without their permission, you know? So many different avenues and places that people can really donate and help out with.
Well, perfect. We'll definitely link all of that in the show notes and make it very actionable for people to reach out to those organizations.
Banning critical race theory. That's what I was thinking about, that, you know, if we have that banned from our educational system, like, again, how do we expect people to get knowledge about what's truly going on?
Okay, so switching gears just a little bit, like, just with the process of midwifery and what people can expect, like, if they're going to choose to work with a midwife. And, you know, again, we've talked about there's many different ways you can do this. You're in the hospital, you know, I've even thought of maybe next time I do this, maybe I would want an at-home birth and to work with a midwife at home. Can you maybe share a little bit of what somebody might experience if they choose to go this route?
Right. So our scope is really, it's based on physiological processes. Like, your body is designed to do the things that it's going to do.
Which I love.
And then, when we're looking at other aspects of healthcare within midwifery, like, you know, abnormal bleeding, that kind of thing, we're looking at, like, okay, we know X, Y, and Z. what has caused like this deviation, and what can we use to maybe help get your body back on track? But going back to your initial question, when you're looking for like pregnancy prenatal care, especially in like the home birth setting, like this is going to be longer prenatal visits. Like you get to sit and talk. Mm-hmm. And for some hospital midwives, they may get longer periods of time if they're in a smaller private practice. So you might get these 45 minute conversations, but for most folks who are going to the hospital, it's like a quick 15 or 20 minutes. You're in and out. You go do your lab somewhere, you do your ultrasound somewhere, you might have follow up with a physician, again, a 15, 20 minute visit. In that 15 to 20 minutes, I'm still striving to give you exceptional care. You know, like, have you looked at this book? Have you started taking classes? Because, and I tell folks, like, in the hospital, I would love to spend an hour with you. They're not going to let me do that.
Right.
So with all that said, I really would like you to explore and you know, what your journey here want, you know, how you want that to look, and then also explore the options of what it looks like if it goes left or right, you know. But at the home, like folks can sit down with their midwife, and even in conjunction with their doula, and like have these conversations of like, what's happening, what you can expect during this time, what's going to happen when it comes down to the birth, because that's super important. Not only like your job is to like take care of yourself and to be prepared for this time as much as possible, but also like if there's an emergency that could happen, you need to know in advance. Like that's not your main thing, but like we want you to know a little bit so that when we start telling you, hey, like maybe we should do this or try this, or I might need to call 911 from home, you know, that it's not like alarms going off, even though they might, but at least you would have had this discussion before. Also, like testing that can be done for the newborn. They take a lot of time just, you know, discussing that, vaccinations, if people want it or don't want it, and rationale. So really, again, that shared decision making, like here's the data, you make the decision that works best for you and your family. Pain relief measures. And this really is, again, your support person, how they can help you, plus like maybe your doula if you have one. And there are folks who not only, you know, want to do home births, but like birth center births, it's the same thing, like a little bit longer of a visit and getting to the birth center, what your plans are. And then postpartum care, which is what I love too. It's like, when you birth at home, the postpartum care, like they check up on you within like a day or two. Mm. Not all hospitals have the capacity to do that. Like, you know, sometimes I have patients who have their baby and I don't know, because like they just don't show up to their appointment, and I'm in clinic that day. We're at a very busy practice. And so it's like, I try to make sure no one gets lost through the cracks, and we have our follow up. And then sometimes I have the good grace of getting to be at the birth of my own clinic patient that I've seen the entire pregnancy. And it's like, you know, oh yes, like the stars have aligned. Yeah. So I'm here for you. But you know, whatever setting you choose to be in, like I said, like midwives will meet you at the beach, we'll meet you in the forest. If you want, we really will. But it's also another important thing is to vet your midwife. Like, you know, what's important to you? Like, how many transfers have you had to the hospital? Which sometimes transfers have to happen. Like, we're not ignorant to the fact that sometimes people need a cesarean section, and that's the reality. Or sometimes people need pain relief. And so when they're going from home to the hospital for whatever reason, you want to make sure your provider is the one who's going to give you guidance or offer recommendation in your favor, but also for the safety of your baby as well. You know,
that's an important question that I have actually, because, you know, I thought about this a lot, like with my birth, my water broke, and then I didn't have Gia for 35 hours after it broke. And so thankful, like I just wasn't dilating, and is essentially what was happening. I also had strep B. So like, I know like the infection risk was like a factor that they were nervous about and all of these things. But I always think about like, what if I would have been at home? There was a point where I finally chose the epidural because I was in, it was just so many hours and I was in so much pain. There was no way I could have, I was going to burn myself out. Like it was. And so I'm like, okay, if I decide to do a home birth this next time, what happens if it goes that same way and I end up truly like wanting to be present for this birth and I need to take the epidural? Or like, what if you need to have a cesarean or something goes wrong? What is the process for that if you're doing a home birth? Is it different for every practitioner that you work with or midwife that you work with?
Essentially, but not really, because for one, you have to know your surroundings. So how close are you to a hospital? If you're going to be super far away, like if we're talking 2 hours away from the hospital, your house is probably not the best place to have your baby. And then, you know, calling 911, you know, is possible, but I've talked with midwives who have called 911 and no one showed up. So like, that's another thing too. How do you manage? A friend of mine who's a midwife and has her own birth center is like, practice like your hospital is 2 hours away. Not that it is, actually is, but practice like it is. Like you, like, so urgency, yeah, you know, that sense of urgency. But going back to what you were saying about the epidural, so at home, there's this understanding, this isn't readily accessible to me.
Right.
There may be other things, like some midwives and some birth center practices have nitrous, which is a gas that you can consider it like laughing gas that you can use to kind of help you. But what is really key is movement. And when you're in the hospital, that's not always, it can be. And I tell, like, so for example, if I have a patient who comes in, such as yourself, with your water broken, you're not contracting, you're not dilated, I'm like, I may offer medication, but I'm also going to tell you, like, let's walk. Mm-hmm. And be like, you have to move, get out of the bed. Mm-hmm. Like, this is your body for birth is not designed to be still. It is not designed to be still. And people, if you watch people birth at home, they move in a way that works for their baby and their body. We don't have to tell them. Sometimes we do, but many times we don't have to tell them exactly where to go. Now, with pain here, sometimes you do have to offer that guidance
They had to be offered. Like, it's interesting that you say that, because I shared this in my birth. I shared updates all the time, like every so often when I was actually having Gia. Mm-hmm. And I was so sad that the midwife, she suggested, like, maybe we take misoprostol to get things going. Or eventually it was Pitocin, like, ended up taking Pitocin. And I so didn't want to. But in the end, I'm glad that I did. But in the moment, she was saying, like, we need to move, or like, it's time for you to switch positions. And I know, like, when I was in pain, there was like a certain position where I was like, I just want to stay here. She's like, we need to move the dial here. Like, we got to switch. And so I was very thankful that they were doing that. And even at OSU, if anyone's in Columbus and they're listening, like, I had the option to have a water birth, which I didn't end up doing, but they had options for me to like stand on a bar and squat if I wanted to. And there was a bouncing ball and I was like over the bed. So there were so many options, even in the hospital setting, where I was able to get up and move around if I wanted to.
And that's not in a disrespectful way, but in a reality, that's a privileged place to be. Mm. Because I would love to put people in a tub. We don't have access to it, you know? Yeah. So everyone's coming from like a different standpoint. You know, your nurse can make or break it too. So like, if the nurse is there and someone who's like about this labor life, they're going to be, if you get the epidural, cool, whatever. And that's the thing. Midwives aren't like, oh, you shouldn't get an epidural. Like, that's not where we come from. We come from like, let's get you the birth that you desire, at least as close as possible.
Yeah.
Or let's guide you in a way that's going to support you as best as possible, right? But like, if you get the epidural, we just need to be helping you flip and get in positions and using a peanut ball and, you know, doing all kinds of things and like seeing where your baby is so that we can kind of try to see where we need to position to get you to get that baby to rotate and come down. Again, like at home, you have access to a shower typically, or a tub or a birth pool. Your doula might be rubbing your back, putting some heat on it, maybe even giving you ice chips, walking with you, like to get this going. So, you know, I hear the concern of like, well, what would have happened, you know, at hour like 24 of
That's like always my concern is like, what if this is my body? Maybe Gia was just stubborn. I don't know, but it makes me nervous, because at some point I remember thinking, if I don't get this, I don't think I'll be present for the rest. And I wouldn't have been. It was like 12 hours after I got the epidural that she finally came. So that's always a fear. I mean, and I'm not thinking about having another child for a long time, but it's still in the back of my head, you know?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And you have to know what works for you, like who you are as a person. And if you've never had a baby before, this is pain that you've never experienced before. So it's like, you know, and people may have like really bad period pain, but it grows away from that at some point in time. Like it's going to be exponentially more than that
yes.
at some point in time. So know yourself, know your support person, know your needs. And I think another thing too, mindset makes a whole difference. I think if you had prepared for a home birth, and I mean, again, this is like as appropriate, if you had prepared for a home birth, knowing you didn't have access to the drugs,
yeah,
it's like, you shape your way in a different manner, and you might have already gone in with the thought that you were not gonna
do an epidural.
But it's easily accessible at the hospital.
Right.
So I'm not saying like this, you know, your birth journey is what it is and you need to do for yourself and for your baby what you need to do. You already said it, like I wouldn't have been present. And there are people who come in at the hospital thinking they're going to get an epidural and their baby's right there. And it's like,
yeah,
I can't. So it goes different from what they expect, but they do it, you know? So it's a matter of mindset. So if you ever, ever, not to be in your uterus business, but if you ever decide to have a child again and home birth or birth center birth is something that you're thinking about, you know, think about ways in which this could be different. And also think about usually, not always, but usually, births go a little bit quicker
the second time around,
and the more you have them. Yeah. But I mean, you have to do what works for yourself. And that's what this midwifery thing is about. It's not about me. I've gone to school. I've gotten facts that they've given me, but I've also known that people know their bodies. They live their own experience. And so what works best for you in this moment, what works best for your lifestyle, what works best for your family, what works best for your baby, and not discounting the baby, because many times people will sacrifice their baby for an experience.
And I want to talk about that actually.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that was the biggest struggle I had during my pregnancy and birth was that, like, for example, when I found out that I had strep B and that the protocol was to do antibiotics during labor every 4 hours, mm-hmm. I was very, very torn between I have the option to say no, you know, like mm-hmm. I can say no. And they can monitor her after she's born and, you know, all of those things. But then at the same time, I was like, but also I like don't want to risk anything happening, you know, like for me not having antibiotics, like I don't want to risk that. And so I kept going back and forth. And ultimately I decided like, let's do the antibiotics. And then when I was at the hospital, and again, like when my water broke at 2:30 in the morning and I got into the hospital, I think around like 11:30 PM or 12 PM, that's when she checked me. My dilation was like, I think you should probably take misoprostol. And I remember being like, I don't know if I'm ready. And then the longer the baby's in there. And then I just had all of these thoughts between this is what I wanted. I wanted an unmedicated birth and I wanted it to go this way. But I also want to do what's best for my baby. Like, I don't want to prolong this situation and maybe have to have a C-section. Not that anything's wrong if you have to have a C-section, but that's another route it could go. Or, you know, my baby could get an infection and I don't want that to happen either. And so that was the hardest, literally like a reshaping of my identity, to be honest, was like, what do I believe in here? Am I sticking to my quote unquote holistic roots, or do I need to do what's best for my health and for my baby's health? And ultimately I went the route with let's go and play it safe. But I still second guess it sometimes, honestly.
Yeah. It's a hard place to be because, and we see this a lot in postpartum and parenting, there's a sense of loss of self this grief to loss of self because you are not who you were before. And you're still like an amazing person, right? You're still this great person, well-deserving of many things, but you're not who you were before. You are also now responsible for another life and the guidance of that life. And so you want to stick true to yourself, but also be true to your child who, in some way, shape, and form are defenseless. Like they need protection. They need someone to look out for them. So it is a tricky balance, and the decision has to be made for yourself of what you want to do and for who, right? And it gets to this gray zone of like, am I doing this because someone's telling me to do it? Or am I doing it because I'm resolving in my mind for myself? I've been given the information of pros and the cons and what can happen, side effects, outcomes. And I'm using that to make a judgment. And when you're in the middle of labor, that's a very tricky
place. Yes, it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard to be. It's always someone's choice of what they want to do. And So like, I'll have patients ask me, well, do I have to? And I'm like, you don't have to do anything here. Like, if you want to go home, you can go home too. And not in a mean or nasty way, but like, you always have the choice to say no to something or for me to call in somebody else and offer a second opinion. Like, I leave those doors open for patients so that they can make the decision that works for them. Because at the end of the day, I'm not going to stop you from what you want to do. Right. I'm going to simply offer my recommendation and we go from there.
I'm curious, you know, what your recommendation would be in that situation. Like, what is your strep B recommendation in case I have it again?
So group beta strep is what we say is transient. So it comes and goes. Like, you could see it one week and then could be gone the next. How often do group beta strep infections really happen? It's very rare. Right. However, when it does happen, it can be fatal. And so again, that is someone's prerogative. I've had patients in our system. We test, we do an early urine pregnancy culture to see if there's any UTI, because during pregnancy, many times there's UTIs that happen. Our bodies are just more susceptible for bacterial growth due to our pregnancy hormones. But we'll test for that. And if group beta strep bacteria shows up in the urine, we consider you positive the remainder of the pregnancy. However, there are some patients who, when it comes down to the 35, 36 weeks, ask to be retested. Mm-hmm. And that is well within your right for us to do. And if that test comes back negative, we don't need to treat you. You know, that's, you know, that again is your prerogative. If it remains positive, we're going to offer you treatment, mm-hmm, and recommend that you get it. But again, that's your decision. Yeah. You know, that's your decision, you know.
Sounded exactly like what my midwives told me too, like within everything. And I remember even with deciding on the two induction drugs, she was like, this is ultimately your decision. This is what she told me. And she was like, but in my experience and the way things are going, I highly recommend. Mm-hmm, and so, yeah. And I trusted her, you know, but again, it's still like, you said it so well, that division between like yourself and your identity and like this new little person, mm-hmm, it is a challenge, but I think that's why you need to trust who you're working with and trust your provider, your midwife.
Absolutely. Make sure you know who you're with. It's funny because I was going to go back to that example, the Cytotec or the misoprostol.
Yeah.
You know, I have patients come in and again, water broke. Maybe it's been a few hours. Well, let's let you walk. And then are you open to us rechecking you and seeing if some change has been made? And, you know, I've folks who choose that. I have folks who choose the Cytotec right away. I've had folks who are like, well, how long will this be? Because I have work tomorrow. And this is like another family member, but also they don't want to use any medication to help them. Yeah. And I'm like, well, it may not happen today. It may happen tomorrow. If I had the crystal ball, I surely would let you know. And also be playing lotto, like if I knew, right? But again, we can only offer the risk benefits and indications for using certain things. You know, even breaking your water, some people are like, I'd rather my water break. Okay, we can wait for that. And sometimes it happens. And then sometimes I'm staring at a bulging bag as we're birthing a baby. And
is there a risk when your water's been broken for a long time? Like, what is the risk? Is infection?
Infection. Mm-hmm, yeah. So, you know, hospital system wise, if we're going on 24 hours, we're checking your temperature fairly regularly. If the temperature starts to increase or baby's heart rate or even your heart rate, and then there's a smell to infection too. So that's not necessarily a diagnostic criteria, but you can smell when someone has what we call chorioamnionitis, which is the infection of that, you know, amniotic fluid, and that affects your uterus. So that's the thing, like, you know, again, the training. So what we know is like, it's not just an infection that should be treated, but what can happen is that affects your labor pattern. Your uterus is now infected as well. And so it's important for us to treat so that your baby is okay, right? That's like
number one.
Yeah, you are okay. And those go together, right? But then your uterus, in order to carry you through to labor, because suppose this happens at like 6 centimeters, we still may have quite a bit of time plus pushing,
right,
to get, yes, through all of this. So my cousin, one of her birth stories, her bag of water, she lives in a different state, her bag of water broke. They sent her home from the hospital. And to me, that's odd because we, well, not odd, but like it's a different practice because we keep people when their background is broken until they have their baby. So she was advised, you know, you make sure your baby's moving. If the color of the fluid changes to green or brown or yellow, you need to come in because that could be meconium where the baby poops inside. If your baby doesn't move well or the contractions, you know, start to turn, you need to come back in. This was not her first rodeo, but all it took was like her one real big contraction and she knew it was time and then went to the hospital. But again, I had said earlier, medicine is a practice. And even though midwifery isn't like MD or DO medicine, we still, there are parts of it that we are still exploring. So if we knew exactly what it was that causes the cascade of labor, we would do that. We would give you this drug or whatever, or say, this is what you should take in order for your labor to get going. But the cascade of labor, while we understand parts of it, it's so intricate and so different from person to person that we offer up the things that we know could work in your favor, you know? So
it's just wild. Like it's it, like, even I wasn't expecting my water to break early because they said like 10% of women's do. And then I was expecting, like, when I went in to be dilated, I was like 1 centimeter and like 80 effaced. But like I can't even tell you how long I was at like 1 centimeter. So it's just interesting, like all these hours. And I'm like, come on, Gia, like, let's get moving. And but she's here now. Like I said, she's 3 months today. She's adorable. I love her to death. It just took her forever to decide to get here.
Their own time. Like we're not, you know, it's their own time. And that's the same thing with like the due date. People get really like hung up on. It's called an estimated due date, EDD. You know, and so I know it's a struggle at 40 weeks, right? Like, I know you're like, get this baby out, you know, but also like give them some time. And then even that towards the end, like, okay, so maybe we should start to try to do some things to help your baby come out if we're headed in that direction. But like, it's okay if you go past this estimated time that we have no idea of the precision of when your baby is supposed to arrive. Like it's okay as long as, you know, I'm talking about in the absence of any complications or need. And so for anyone listening to, like, that was not my medical advice on like what you should do if your bag of water breaks. You should always speak with your provider. Or call the labor nurses if you have a line to that, or your midwife, whoever it is, to see what a good plan of care is, because they'll help you. This is not standard for everyone. Mm-hmm. It, you know, specific for individuals. So
yep, goes back to trusting who you're working with and asking all the questions. Being a huge advocate for yourself.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been amazing, and thank you so much for coming on. I'm so fascinated by midwifery and childbirth and all of these things. And so I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge and education with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode. I hope that you all enjoyed it. Make sure to check out the links in the show notes if you're looking to donate or share educational resources with others so that we can continue to make the necessary changes within our medical system. You can also follow and catch up with Ayanna on Instagram, where you can find her at The Vagina Chronicles. All right, I cannot wait to catch you all next week with a new guest, and I will talk to you soon.